This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, let's imagine that you and me have got a job share as newly appointed infrastructure minister charged with rebalancing the economy between the north of England and the southeast. What should we do?
Within Northwestern is delayed by approximately 13 minutes.
Oh. As a consultant at the local hospital, all the cancellations and delays really impact on my working week to the point where sometimes it's really quite embarrassing how late we arrive.
It's got to the point now where I'm seriously looking for another job.
I mean, it's actually quite impressive that they can make it so awful.
We just feel like we've been forgotten about, you know. Everyone's concentrating up London End, you know, where all the money is.
Experiences like that and sentiments like that have helped lead to the latest bout of government promising to rebalance the country's economy. In recent days, the Chancellor of the Exchequer heralded a coming infrastructure revolution, most of it thought to be in the north of England. Much of the focus is likely to be improving transport networks. More details are likely to emerge in the budget in March. So this week, I want to know what it will take to make such an infrastructure revolution real, and to what extent could it power up the northern economy. Step inside the briefing room. First stop, Leeds. Joining me in the briefing room is Geraldine Scott of the Yorkshire Post. Geraldine, how big an issue is transport for the readers of the Yorkshire Post?
God, it's all we hear about. If you look at our letters page on any day, it's full of people moaning about the trains, moaning about the roads, moaning about the buses, and, you know, with good cause. People can't get to work, they can't get to school, and they're missing appointments all over the place. It's a massive issue.
So when you're in Leeds, which is where the Yorkshire Post is based, how do you find it?
In Leeds, it's almost always quicker to walk. You think you get around London, you've got the tube, it's very quick, the bus is very good, you could jump in a taxi if you really wanted to. And the difference is shocking, to be honest. So our sister paper, the Yorkshire Evening Post, did an experiment where four reporters, they started from the same distance away from our office and had to try and get to work and see who got there the quickest. And one person cycled, one person got the bus, one person got the train, and one person drove. And the cyclist got there quickest. And, you know, the train and the bus, they were delayed. It's a disaster. And the person that drove got stuck in traffic. So it just proves the point.
Why are the buses so bad? Is it just the traffic?
Some of it is definitely the traffic. You know, the buses simply can't get through. The roads aren't good enough for them to get through. But the other thing is there's no system in place for people to actually be able to access, for example, bus times in real time, know when your buses are coming. For example, you know, you've got your classic timetable, you can see it online as some kind of PDF, or you think going to a London example, you have an app that you can look on that will quickly show you the time, and it's accurate, it's up to date, it tells you if it's delayed, what stop it's going to, how long it's going to take you to walk to that stop. You can use your debit card and credit card to get on it, or you might have a pass, and then, you know, you've got an Oyster card which caps out. Now, none of that is available for people in Yorkshire. You know, it was just in the last couple of weeks, it's been announced that's not going to be possible for a Yorkshire transport network. They say that it's not possible, can't be done, it's too complicated. Buses are very important because more people actually travel on buses than they do trains. And we hear a lot about the trains, but not so much about the buses.
Why do you think that is?
They're the method of travel for more deprived communities. It's as simple as that.
The trains are expensive or delayed or both or cancelled or
all. If you stand at Leeds station in the morning and look at the departure board, you'll see cancellation, cancellation, delayed, cancellation, cancellation.
On a regular day?
On a regular day. It's not an oddity to turn up and find that your train is cancelled. And then you might be on a Pacer train, which is essentially just an old bus with some train wheels put on it. So it's a complete mess.
Does that hold true if you travel between cities, if you travel from Leeds to Manchester or Hull or York?
It does. So one of the big things that the Conservatives have been pushing recently is that they want to invest in Northern Powerhouse Rail. Some people call it HS3. And this is linking northern cities. It's supposed to improve the connectivity between places like Leeds and Manchester, which is a ridiculous journey. It's really not far at all. You're talking like 45 miles. But it's Victorian infrastructure that hasn't been updated for, you know, centuries now. So how do we expect modern trains to work on that network? It's impossible.
Is the feeling amongst people in Yorkshire that this time, given all the promises that are being made by this government, something big is going to be done about the situation of transport and other infrastructure in the north?
The noises so far have been positive, but the noises have been positive in the past as well. I think one of the big indicators is going to be what happens with HS2 in the next few months. We're waiting for the OCAVI review, which is the government's kind of independent review in whether it should go ahead or not. And the really important bit is going to be if Boris Johnson keeps the bit that goes from Birmingham up to Leeds, because without that connection, then it doesn't really matter. So we'll see what he does.
Geraldine Scott underlining the need for big investment. But where does the money go now and why? To explain how such spending decisions are made, I'm joined by economist Dr. Marianne Sensier from the Alliance Business School at the University of Manchester. She's on the line from Salford. Now, how much does spending at the moment on transport investment differ across the country?
It differs quite substantially in terms of more money is currently spent in London. If you look at the 2017 figures for this, based on the Institute for Public Policy Research, they estimated that over £4,000 per head was spent in London, compared to the next place's West Midlands with over £3,000 spent per head. This was from 2017 onwards. So that takes into account future HS2 spending for the West Midlands. But then if you look at the other extreme, Yorkshire and Humber had the lowest amount spent on it. That was only £844 per head.
So these are really huge disparities.
Yeah.
How does government decide which bids for transport investment should be best received?
Government looks at the business case that local authorities have or other agencies have worked up, and they have a business case, and within that business case you have the economic case, which has cost-benefit analysis. This cost-benefit analysis gives you a benefit-cost ratio, the return to the investment. And they're essentially looking for the return to the investment to be over two. So every £1 you spend, you get £2 return. But when you're comparing schemes in the north and schemes in the south, what you find is some schemes in London and the southeast have been funded when they're just under two. And schemes in the north, which are over three, for example, don't necessarily get funded.
So that's a straightforward bending of their own rules.
At the end of the day, it's a political decision what kind of investment they want to make. I mean, I can give you some examples of this. The Docklands Light Railway, London Airport, City Airport link had a benefit cost ratio of 1.7 and was funded. And then in 2017, the government cancelled a number of schemes, including the electrification of the line between Oxenholme and Windermere, the Lakes line, which had a benefit cost ratio of 2.3. But the National Audit Office looked at these schemes in 2017, and what they found was after government delays and procurement failures, the benefit cost ratios were then revised down because there was a lot of time taken to look into these projects. Whereas in London, what seems to happen is the projects start pretty rapidly. So even if the ratio falls over time, the work has already started.
So what factors does the cost-benefit analysis take into account?
The wages that people earn and also house prices and land values. So what you find is these values are generally higher in the southeast. So if you're comparing projects between the north and the south, the projects in the southeast will be higher.
Are you saying that the cost-benefit analysis is skewed towards London because the sorts of things you're measuring are more likely to be high in London.
Yes, it favours dense population settlement.
And your argument was also that the cost-benefit ratio was not actually measuring some other important things.
It only takes into account marginal differences, small changes in the local economy. In London, in a very dense economy, Crossrail 2 would just be a small addition to an already very good transport system, whereas Northern Powerhouse Rail would be linking up cities that already have very poor connectivity, and there would be a much better uplift by spending that money in the north because you would have a much denser network that people could travel to and give them greater opportunity for going to get higher paid jobs. And more businesses would probably move into the area if there was better connectivity.
Have you been sympathetically received?
Well, we have shared our research paper with the Treasury and the Department of Transport. And from what I understand with recent media coverage, the government is thinking about levelling up investment in the regions. Hopefully it will start skewing the transport infrastructure more to the north.
Dr. Marianne Sensier. But is money all you need to bring about an infrastructure revolution? Alasdair Reisner is chief executive of SECA, which represents the civil engineering contractors who build and maintain our transport and other infrastructure projects. Alasdair Reisner, everybody's talking about this coming transport infrastructure revolution. What are the impediments, or what are the principal impediments to actually fulfilling it?
The first impediment is the fact that we don't yet have a full plan for what it's going to look like. There's some bold ambitions around connecting up the great cities of the north and getting access into some of those places that have perhaps been left behind before. But unfortunately, no one's done the groundwork.
So to have a plan is one thing. To implement a plan is another thing. Could we go through some of the difficulties which there are in simply doing stuff once you've said you're going to do it?
Clearly, one of the big challenges for delivering major infrastructure projects is it does rely upon a large number of employees to deliver that. Without those people, we just can't put in place the proposals to deliver this because we'd be setting ourselves up to fail.
And why would it be a problem getting the people?
If your listeners think back to when they were at school, I'm betting there weren't many people that were pushing them towards a career in construction. That's a career of last resort. We've got to turn that around. There are some specific roles that I think we have real challenges for. Some of the commercial roles, the people who look after the numbers are vital, and we're not bringing through enough of those people to meet the demand that we've got.
What about the actual construction workers?
For construction workers, we see there's some certain pinch point skills. We have got a shortage of brick workers. We also see ground workers, basically the people who come in first and lay down what we need before everyone else comes to deliver. It's a real skill shortage.
Now, what kind of people would that mean that you would have to attract? And where are they now?
We're probably fishing in a relatively shallow pond. Very often, particularly in London and the South East, they're migrant workers from the EU. And that would be fine if we didn't have any coming problems in terms of potential future inward migration. Increasingly, when you look across the industry as a whole, there is a very much an ageing profile, and that means that they're going to start falling off the end of the conveyor belt at some point fairly soon. And if we don't have a plan to refill from the bottom, we're not going to have the numbers of people that we need.
Does the government have such a plan?
I think the government recognises that in order to achieve its policy objectives, it has to unlock new skills for our sector. I think they are looking at the migration system, but I also think they're looking much more closely at apprenticeships. At the moment, you'll probably have seen there are some challenges around apprenticeship delivery in the UK, but we feel that it is heading in the right direction. It just needs a bit of a push. We will inevitably have to grow the workforce, and I think that's where this industry-level plan working with government needs to kick into place.
So how do you grow a workforce when you've got pretty much full employment?
And that is one of the fundamental challenges. And so you are definitely seeing a big productivity challenge for the industry, looking at innovation as a means to deliver projects with fewer people.
So, Alasdair, do we currently have the people we need to build this infrastructure in the north?
Some of the stuff we're talking about, the time horizon gives us the time to act, but we do need to act.
Alasdair Reisner. All right, armed with this information, I'm now going to shapeshift into the Minister for Infrastructure, seeking advice on how much and how quickly regions can be transformed by infrastructure. To advise me, I've chosen Paul Swinney from the think tank The Centre for Cities and Tom Forth, Head of Data at the Open Data Institute, Leeds. OK, gentlemen, I'm
infrastructure minister. I've got the job and I've got the brief to make the North and the Midlands thrive again. And I need your advice. And my first question, I suppose, is, have we been here before? Paul, what do you think?
You know, if we're talking about not just infrastructure, but trying to narrow the gap between the performance of the south of England and the north of Midlands, you know, we've got an 85, 86-year track record on this. The first attempt at this was the 1934 Special Areas Act in the aftermath of the Great Depression, trying to help places of very high unemployment. And they've had an array of policies, you know, through the decades. And even since 2010, we've had rebalancing the economy, which was sort of the coalition's slogan. We've had the Northern Powerhouse, which was the Cameron Osborne slogan. And now we've got levelling up.
Did those efforts work, Paul?
Well, they didn't, because we're still talking about it. You know, now those efforts sort of in the microcosm there underline the general approach that was taken in that time, which was very much more about we need to try and protect what we've got and preserve what's there already, rather than helping places to adapt to an ever-changing and ever-evolving economy. And policies actually prevented that from happening.
Well, that's interesting. Can you give examples, Paul?
Examples would be, say, trying to prevent the closure of certain manufacturing industries in certain parts of the country, right through to, say, George Osborne's March of the Makers. You know, we're going to, you know, rebalance the economy towards manufacturing, rather than saying, hang on a minute, what are we doing to try and attract in these new businesses that didn't exist 5 years ago?
And is it your argument that these, in the end, substituted for a better policy?
Yes, it's been very much more about trying to protect what's there rather than saying, well, you know, the changing winds mean that we've got to have lots of high-skilled workers, we've got to have good transport systems, you know, commercial property space that, you know, businesses want to move into, new businesses that are being invented.
Tom, how unbalanced are the economies, North and South, that I, as Minister, am looking at?
The UK has, I would say, of the developed nations, has the most regionally unequal economy. I would say London and South East, the productivity is 40 to 50% higher on average than, say, the north of England.
So, hold on, let's unpick for the listener and indeed for the minister what that actually means. Why is that the case?
Typically, it's because they do different types of job. So there's a lot more high value added industry, whether it's law work, creative industries is a massive one in the southeast. So scientific development, and then the type of work that people are more likely to do in the Midlands and the North are just industries which have a lower value add to them. I don't think that means that the jobs themselves are lower value. They simply produce less value to the economy.
Sorry, does that mean that, let's say, somebody working in the city is counted as being more productive than somebody working in heavy industry in the North? Because the value of what they do is more in monetary terms, Paul.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Now, I've heard people say, as Minister, that London's the problem here. It just kind of sucks everything in. Is that a perception that works for you?
Now, you know, it gets described as being a dark star, for example, like you say, sort of sucking all this activity in, which, you know, in principle, I've got some sympathy with. But if you look at the performance of places around London, let's say Reading or Milton Keynes or Crawley, for example, they've got very strong economies. Now, if it was the principle that London was just sucking all of the activity in, then you would expect that the places closest to London would be the ones that have the weakest economies. And that is not the case. So while I can understand why people get frustrated about it, actually, when you look at the data, it's not quite so clear cut. And I think the argument here needs to be much more about how do we try and improve the performance of cities elsewhere in the country rather than trying to pull London down. Now, going to the back of the question about why should ministers care about this? You know, we've had a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, productivity levels in the UK in recent years. And the line is that a German worker or a French worker produces in 4 days what a UK worker produces in five. That is true, but the geography of this is very, very interesting. So if you look at the Greater South East of England, you see that actually an average worker in the Greater South East of England produces more than what a German worker does, and more than what a French worker does. The issue is elsewhere in the country. So from a ministerial point of view, if we care about productivity and overall performance of the UK economy, what we need to be doing is getting these places firing, because our big cities in particular, like Manchester, Birmingham, Glasgow, are punching well below their weight, and they should be doing much better than what they currently are.
Now, I'm told that one of the key things you would do is transport, and that it's one of the quickest ways. Tom, do you agree with that?
The reason why I think it's a good win is that currently it's so poor. So in and out of Leeds, Sheffield, Manchester, Birmingham, you've got huge numbers of very crowded trains that would be cheap to make better. They don't need new lines building. They just need to be longer trains, and there's space to make them longer. They need to be electric trains. people in London and the South East might want to look up on Wikipedia or something what a diesel train is, because I don't think you have any anymore around there, basically. If you made them electric, they would be cheaper and faster and easier to run. They could get more people in and out of the cities. And the key argument for any transport investment, really, is to make the cities bigger, because there is quite a strong evidence link that says bigger cities, all other things being equal, are more productive and have stronger economies. And what we found, we did a piece of work in Birmingham, for example, where we tracked every single bus. What we found is that a public transport system in Birmingham, which is reliant on the bus, since there is no metro and there is only one tram line, is just smaller. It makes Birmingham smaller, and that makes it poorer. So we fixed that. We fixed Birmingham's productivity problem in parts.
Paul, does that mean that transport within a conurbation is more important than transport between conurbations?
In the research that we've done, absolutely. It's much more about transport within and around cities. You know, think about the London Underground network for Manchester or for Leeds, as opposed to thinking about, you know, fast whizzy trains between Manchester and Leeds. Now, it's absolutely true that the train connection between Manchester and Leeds is really, really slow, and loads slower than the connection to Milton Keynes in London or Cambridge in London. But the political emphasis that's being given to that is way overblown compared to the likely impact it's likely to have.
So, should HS2 and HS3 proceed? Should we carry on with them? Are they of significant use to the regeneration project? Tom?
It's a hard one to answer. There are many higher and better priorities for transport in the north of England and the Midlands than HS2 and HS3. But I do not believe that if you cancel HS2 or HS3, a single one of them will be funded. What will happen if we cancel HS2 or HS3, I believe, is we will fund worst value transport investment in and around London. So for that reason, not hugely enthusiastically, as you might be able to hear, I support building HS2 and HS3. Investment of any type is better than no investment.
What about you, Paul? Do you think that HS2 and HS3 actually do help regeneration, or are they irrelevant to it?
Well, HS3 in particular, or Northern Powers Rail, has been called this week, for example. It seems to change its name all the time. It's been very much sold on this idea that, you know, people can live in one city and they'll commute along to another city just like that. And it happens in Holland and it happens in Germany. Well, when we've actually done the research on the relevant areas of Holland and Germany, we see that it doesn't happen like that. They are more productive, they have got better trains, but people tend to live and work in the broadly the same sort of city region area rather than sort of travelling between. Now, the key question I think we need to ask on this is, why would somebody choose to live on the east side of Leeds and then commute all the way to Manchester every day when you could buy a house in, say, Tameside or Stockport for a similar sort of price, and you wouldn't have to have the time cost of doing the journey, and you wouldn't have the ticket cost of doing the journey too. You know, the reason why people travel so far into London is because housing's dead expensive, and the pay rates as well within London are much higher than around. So actually the pull factor outweighs the push factor. So I've sort of given you the economic case, and I don't think it stacks up. I think it's much more about trying to focus on transport investment within the city region. Otherwise, we're just going to be in the same position in 30 years' time where we go, you never guess what, we've had north-south divide policies for 110 years now and still hasn't worked. And in the 2020s, we put all this money into a rail line, but it didn't work. I just don't want us to be in that position.
To be provocative and to help you as the minister, I think there's a way that me and Paul can agree on this. I'll make a suggestion. You, the minister, could take the budget of HS2 and HS3 and you could give it to the cities that it goes to. You could just say, here's £100 billion, £150 billion, here's the money. You choose what you want to do. And I am pretty confident that soon, Greater Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds, Sheffield, Nottingham, the places where HS2 is really going to speed up journeys to and from and between, I think they might think quite a lot harder about whether they want that fast new railway line once they can see the money and once they have the choice of doing something different.
Now, as Infrastructure Minister, one of the things I've heard again and again recently is about buses. Everybody's very concerned about buses, particularly in some of the regions we're talking about. Are better buses a significant part of the answer here? And I suppose I ask because I'm just worried they'll just get stuck in the traffic.
In short order, buses, yes, are the answer. You know, we're talking about transport that is much cheaper than rail investment. You literally just put a bus on a road. You know, they go to many more places. Buses serve many more people on a daily basis than what trains do. And the big issue in a lot of our cities in the north of England, in stark contrast to London, is our buses do not operate very well. You know, they're operated by private operators that are only maximising their profits rather than thinking about the broader element of how does this transport system work. And it's not a system that's designed to link people where they live to where the jobs are and where the economic prosperity is. And that's what we need to get right.
Tom, so why don't these places just run their buses better?
Buses cost a lot of money. They don't cost money to buy, but they cost a lot of money to run. It costs nearly £800 million per year to run the buses in London. And that money that's required to subsidise the fares on the buses is paid for by people paying tube fares and train fares. So the tube fares are higher than they need to be and the bus fares are lower than they should be. And you cross-subsidise across the two things.
So, Paul, you need, effectively, to have everything coming under broadly the same umbrella. The same people planning your light railway and your trams and your trains are also planning your buses.
Precisely. And that is exactly what happens in London. Transport for London has been in place for two decades now, doing exactly that. I don't really understand why we haven't got TfL-style bodies in our other big cities. It seems like a really easy policy win. And that would bring all of those transport options together, coordinate them, allow it to cross-subsidise, invest, borrow to invest in the way that Greater Manchester or Liverpool or Leeds just can't do at the moment.
Tom, a quick and straightforward point. Should these places be allowed to take the buses back into public ownership, which runs a bit contrary to what my party did in the past, but maybe we should rethink?
I think they should be allowed to take the buses back into public ownership, but I suspect most of them will choose not to. I don't think that the Mayor of Greater Manchester wants to be sat down writing bus timetables and rotoring decisions and filling up buses with diesel. I think that he will be happy, as happens in most of the rest of Europe, to say there are some fantastic bus operating companies, I'm going to outsource the running of the buses to you, but I will set fares and I will set timetables. That's what I think is the best way.
Tom, what would success look like? How would I know as infrastructure minister and also as a minister responsible for attempting to get regeneration into the region, how would I know when I've succeeded or if my legacy had been one of success?
So I think that's a really good question. When Germany reunified, it had a really big promise that it would bring the East up to the living standards and the economic strength of the West. It still hasn't achieved that. But it has achieved quite a lot. But we are talking many, many decades of huge dedication and a lot of money in order to bring the east of Germany up to now a stronger economy than the north of England. We also need to just be realistic that regional inequality within the UK is never going to go away. There's only two real world cities in Europe. You can only say that Paris within Europe is the equal of London in terms of its global reach and importance to the world. So Leeds should not be saying we want to be like London. But if you ask people on the street, they'll tell you they don't want to be like London. They're quite happy living in Leeds. But they do want Leeds to be a little bit more like some of the cities in Europe that are more prosperous, do a bit better. So I don't think we're ever going to get rid of regional inequality. We could probably bring it down a bit. And I think that in terms of timescales, right, you are looking at 30 years. If you look at, say, Scotland's economic performance compared to Yorkshire, this is one that I think shows what might be possible. 20 years ago, Scotland and Yorkshire were similar strength economies. Today, Scotland's economy is 15% stronger. So you get 15% over 20 years with quite a lot of money. That's the kind of scale of change we can achieve. It's not going to catch up a 45, 50% gap, which it currently exists between the north and the southeast of England.
That was Tom Forth with Paul Swinney. And my conclusion is there are no easy fixes and quick wins here. This is a century-old problem. But if we invest in the right transport infrastructure on a large enough scale, it would certainly go some way to rebalance the country. My thanks to Geraldine Scott, Dr. Marianne Sensia, Alasdair Reisner, Paul Swinney and Tom Forth. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Jordan Dunbar and Rosamund Jones. The editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might find other episodes interesting, including ones on who are the Islamic Revolutionary Guard of Iran, how safe is vaping and what does getting Brexit done actually mean? You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.